On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the day, as Hollywood had it anyway, the danger zone for a marriage came at year 7 with an itch. Here it is from 1955 when the itchy husband, played by Tom Ewell, has just met the blonde bombshell played by Marilyn Monroe in The 7-Year Itch.
Doctor, I'm in serious trouble. I'm married.
Serious trouble? Married? So far, absolutely normal.
I've been married for 7 years. And I'm afraid I'm coming down with what you and Dr. Steichel call the 7-year itch. What am I going to do?
If something itches, my dear sir, the natural tendency is to scratch.
And there comes trouble. Well, that was then. A big study now says marital bliss starts to tumble at year 3. With or without Marilyn Monroe next door, and not just for guys, we're going to look at new marriage and what it takes to make it through the rough spots. This hour on Point, love, marriage, and the 3-year itch. Joining me first today is Sam Roberts, reporter for the New York Times. His article, The Shelf Life of Bliss, recently picked up on the report out of the University of Wisconsin. Sam, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's the news? What's it say, Sam?
Well, I'm happy to say that I'm happily married and have been for more than 7 years, but this study by Professor Music and Larry Bumpus at University of Wisconsin, she's at University of Southern California, seemed to suggest that while 3 years is not a magical number, the relationship is generally better in the first 3 years than it is after that, and that goes for either marriage or cohabitation.
So 3 years is kind of the tipping point. You remind us that for marriages that do end up in divorce, 7 years is the median length or duration of those marriages. But their study is saying that the trouble may start earlier if that's the path people get on?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think, again, I'd be careful of pitting it on 3 years precisely, but somewhere around that point, somewhere before the 3-year mark or somewhere before 4 or so, the relationship begins to lose a little spark, a little fizz. In some cases, of course. In many cases, people stay happily married eternally, practically. But in lots of cases, because of maybe our souped-up culture, because of our expectations about marriage, because of lots of other factors, the relationship seemed to be souring somewhere in that earlier stage. Now, how that compares to earlier times, we don't know for sure. There hasn't been much research. But we do know the theory of the 7-year itch, as you explained it from that movie, and also the statistical fact that people who divorce in a first marriage usually do so after 7 or 8 years.
So you quote a therapist saying people are used to everything being disposable. They throw out diapers, lighters, coffee cups so they can throw out a marriage. What is the bigger context here, Sam, about marriage rates and durability of marriage in this country right now?
Well, I think, Tom, we're still very, very far from the European model, the Scandinavian model of people mostly living together, mostly having out-of-wedlock children, although those numbers are certainly rising. One of the things to recall is that 9 out of 10 or so Americans still eventually get married, but the fact is that we're spending a shorter proportion of our lives in marriage, whether it's blissful marriage or not, and that's mostly because people are marrying later, although they are marrying, and they are living longer, so there are more widows and, to some extent, widowers who are surviving the marriages as well.
So, but it's the durability of enchantment, your phrase, and it's a good one, that they're looking at here. And what, enchantment going after 3 years? Do they talk about what replaces it? Is there evidence here of what makes marriages last? Do people have to look for something other than, you know, sort of champagne fizz?
Well, I think that's exactly what they have to do. First of all, I quote one therapist, Paul Neuthaler, is saying that, you know, if you're just looking for if the basis for the marriage is purely physical, then not associated with someone's essential character, then it's not likely to last forever. There has to be something deeper. Nowadays, there has to be more of a partnership. There has to be a recognition of more egalitarian roles when there so many women are working, and working not necessarily because they have to work, but because they want to work. There's delayed childbearing. The Pew Research Center study that I also quote in the story points out that childbearing is not as crucial to marriage or marital bliss as it once was a relatively short time ago. People are very proud of their children, they care about their children, but they don't necessarily think they have to have children to have a happy marriage.
So maybe less dependence on a spouse and maybe less supportive tissue beyond love and commitment, which you describe, one of the authors of this report, is calling fragile, love fragile.
Oh, I think that's right, Tom. You have all the makings of a marriage counselor there.
I think I will not pick up that challenge, but I wish everybody well with it. Sam Roberts, thanks for bringing our attention to this, and thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure.
Sam Roberts with the New York Times. We're looking this hour at marital happiness and the three-year itch. Joining me now is Kelly Music at the University of Southern California. She's a sociologist. She's tracked marital happiness in the Big Marriage Study with her co-author, Wisconsin professor Larry Bumpus. Kelly Music, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what is it that happens at 3 years?
Well, we can't be real precise about when this happens, but we observe individuals and couples over a 6-year period, and we find pretty consistent evidence that those in the first 3 years of their relationship are happier on a range of outcomes than those in the later years, the years 4 through 6 of their relationship.
Did you track the same people across 6 years, or you just looked at how long they'd been married, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 6 years?
No, we did. We looked at the same individuals. So we had the opportunity to survey them at an initial time point and then could compare levels of happiness and satisfaction 6 years later based on changes in marital status and cohabitation and other aspects of their other changes in their life.
Right. And how do you measure that? What kind of questions do you ask to figure out if they're happy or happier now or then?
Well, we have some individual outcomes. So we ask people about their happiness, and this is a very general question. Goes something like, taking things all together, how would you say things are these days? We ask about their health. We ask about depressive symptoms and self-esteem. And among the couples, we ask, again, a global question about relationship quality, taking all things together, how would you describe your relationship? We ask them how life would be if they separated. Would it be better or worse on a number of items like standard of living, social life, career, happiness, sex life? We ask about time together, disagreements, and fights.
Mm. So your co-author, Larry Bumpus, said some folks start getting less happy at the wedding reception. Oh, my.
That's right.
That's fast. But at this break point or tipping point, whatever you want to call it, the itch point at 3 years, how significantly did you find happiness has diminished by then? Just a little bit or a lot?
Well, that's a good question. Part of what we are trying to say in this study is that it's important to look at the magnitude of these differences. Part of what we were trying to do in this work is address arguments about marriage, about the benefits of marriage, and we wanted to put these in the context of, you know, one, how big are they, and two, how do they compare to living with someone outside of marriage, and three, what do they look like over time? So, you know, the changes in individual or couple-level satisfaction are statistically significant, we say, in the sense that, you know, these are not just differences that we would expect to see in our sample, but we would expect to see them in the national population. But they're not huge. Do they matter? They probably do for any individual. But the changes are reasonably modest to start with.
And still
they
that median
tend to dissipate over time.
Right. But that median point of divorce for people who get divorced is at 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I guess you're suggesting that the root of that divorce may track back to about 3 years.
Well, right. So the 7-year itch, Sam, I think, did a real nice job of describing this. It's sort of a theory, a way of describing something we know about the typical marriage. But really what that is, you know, if you take a pool of divorced individuals, you find that half divorce before 7 years and half divorce after. It's not really that we see a big spike at year 7. And, you know, the same really might be true with what we're looking at. So in other words, we find that couples or individuals who were married, you know, within the first 3 years are happier than those who are married later. But we can't, you know, say that there's really a spike at year three. So we might be seeing just a gradual decline in people's satisfaction over time.
Is it your sense that it was ever thus? It's always been this way? Or do we have, Sam quotes a therapist saying we've got a television clicker culture now and sort of ready to switch channels quicker than we used to be, even on marriage.
Right. I mean, that might be part of it. I think there's potentially quite a bit going on. First, you know, you have much fuzzier rules about marriage. It's not so clear anymore who's supposed to earn the main living and who's supposed to take care of the kids and do the dishes and laundry and so forth. And so, you know, these changing rules about what marriage is this a place where you're supposed to have kids, or is it okay to have a childless or child-free marriage? Is it okay to have kids outside of marriage? All of these things are changing so that people's roles are not as clearly prescribed.
Of course, the seven-year itch has been around for a long time. In this scene from the movie 1955, Marilyn Monroe rings her neighbor's bell for assistance when she's locked out.
I'm terribly sorry to bother you, but I forgot the key to my front door, so I had to ring your bell. I feel so silly.
It's perfectly all right. Anytime.
Boom. And the itch is underway in the seven-year itch. Kelly Music joins us this hour. She's co-author of a big new report out of the University of Wisconsin. She's assistant professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. She's been married for, Kelly, 3 years, is it now?
Just about.
All right. So you're coming into the zone. Also joining us right now with me in the studio is Janice Levine. She's a clinical psychologist and marriage therapist, specializes in couples relationships, co-author of Why Do Fools Fall in Love, founder of the Couples Health Program. Janice Levine, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
So Kelly and her co-author, Larry Bumpus, have gone out. 9,000 plus people they've followed here, and you hear what they found. You're out there counseling couples, I guess. Are you surprised by this number, by the three-year itch idea?
I'm not surprised at all. Actually, I think what we're talking about is the fading of romantic love that happens over the first 3 years and what happens to people in terms of their expectations of keeping that alive and staying stimulated by that kind of high.
3 years? That's as long as it lasts?
It only
3 years and out?
3 years. I mean, Helen Fisher, who's an anthropologist, she measures it in the brain chemistry and the MRIs, and it just seems to disappear after about 2 to 4 years maximum.
So what do you tell couples to put in the tank if that gas is gone?
Well, actually, what it's replaced by is attachment. And if people know how to nurture their intimacy and develop that attachment and learn how to develop skills to sort of see each other as they are and come to some sort of compromises with each other, they seem to be able to go the distance.
Kelly, how about it? You're right at the 3-year mark in your own marriage. In addition to your research here, are you ready to jettison romantic love and go to attachment? It sounds a lot less grand.
Oh, gee, it does. Oh, I don't know. You know, my husband hates when I throw statistics at him.
And I bet I think, he does, you know, especially these.
I think in a sense that his instincts are right on. You know, our study and really most of the studies that we draw our information about family life from are based on dominant patterns. And so when we're talking about what's going on out there, we're drawing on, you know, what's the so-called typical experience. And we know that there's a lot of individual variation around these typical experiences. So some couples, as, you know, my co-author said, are less happy at the wedding reception. But, you know, for some couples, they have ups and downs, and their relationship may increase in satisfaction over time. So, you know, I guess we're all hoping we beat the averages.
Janice, Sam Roberts quoted Dr. Ruth, the famous sex advisor, saying that it is dangerous to even talk about a 3-year itch. So you get that idea out there and suddenly people get it in their heads, 3 years and the romance is gone, it's done, you know, it's a problem even to suggest it or talk about it.
I don't think that's true. I think we have to become aware that we are falsely determined by this Hollywood vision of romantic bliss and that we have an expectation that it stay that way forever, and we need to replace that with different images in Hollywood and different understandings in the media of what it means to stay happily married. So people need to be prepared for the fact that this is going to decline and it needs to be nurtured into something else.
So get your game on, even if it's a different game.
Right.
Let's take some calls here. Claire's calling from Ansonia, Connecticut. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know? Have you got the itch, Claire? Have you had it?
Well, you know, it's difficult for me to tell because at year three, my husband and I had two-year-old twin boys. We had our children very early in our marriage. So it's hard for me to know whether I went through an itchy patch or whether I'm heading up for a seven-year itchy patch. We're so busy arguing about the kids, where they're going to school, why are they fighting, are they seeing us fighting about them, am I nagging the kids, am I nagging my husband, is he nagging me? It's like the children have become the total focus. I'm wondering if other people have that same experience, like the marriage takes the back burner compared to the lives of these little creatures.
You're so busy tickling the kids, you don't know about your own itch. Maybe, Claire, stick with us. Kelly, what about it? What did you find in the numbers? Did people with children at 3 years have more or less fizz left in their marriage?
Well, we find the same results for those who do and don't have kids. That is, you know, for both sets of couples, their relationship tends to decline in satisfaction over time. But broader research has looked more specifically on how kids affect marriage. And having children, the research pretty consistently shows that, you know, that really produces declines in marital happiness, less time spent together, less intimacy. And so, you know, I think couples do kind of set themselves up for a lot of disappointment by, you know, the happy times in pregnancy, expecting things to just be really blissful. And kids bring a lot of challenges, time crunch, financial strain, and a lot of new issues for couples to work through.
But Janice, at this point, I find myself wondering about how we're measuring happiness here. I mean, aren't children supposed to also be a kind of manifestation or the fruit of a deeper satisfaction?
See, that's another misconception. People have all these expectations and they're disillusioned. You know, the research shows that in the first 3 years of a child's firstborn's life, then the marriage happiness tends to decline, and that's it's obvious that people are going to be negotiating many more stressors and many more demands, and that children are going to stress the marriage.
But isn't that a superficial measure of happiness then? I mean, is there no deeper satisfaction that's kicking in at the same time?
Well, only if people put their marriage on the front burner. And our caller is very right to say people are always putting it on the back burner in favor of taking care of the children. And that's a big no-no. The marriage has to be on the front burner because that is what is going to ensure your children's well-being.
Claire, do you have room for your marriage on the front burner there?
You know, I'm in the middle of selling my business, so I have more room for my family. So I'm glad to know I'm on the right track.
Well, make the time. Keep the candles out. Pop the cork once in a while, Claire.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Great to have you. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Scott. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd just like to say I have kind of the reverse experience of what y'all are talking about. I got married very late, around 30 years old. My wife and I had a child, and she was pregnant about 9 months into our marriage.
Yeah.
And from that point forward, we'd had a very, very, very rocky period. It lasted almost 3 years. And after that three-year period, we had kind of a crisis, and things have really resolved themselves, and we are in a much stronger marriage than we were before that. So we had everything on the front end instead of on the back end.
How do you explain it, Scott? Because the kids came early, the tough stuff came early, then you got over the hump?
I don't know. I don't know. I think a lot of it, in my mind, is just we suck it out. We chose to be together. And, I mean, I think a lot of marriage is choosing to stay together through the bad and the good.
Yes.
And not expecting the good all the time.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I think there has to be a commitment to go the distance with each other and to recognize that there will be some tough times, but marriage is about a lifetime commitment and that you understand that you'll get through the bad times. And if you need some help, you ask for help or you learn how to do it yourselves because you were, in fact, a little bit older and more mature when you got married. So congratulations.
Mm. Kelly Music, what is it like to sit with these statistics in the middle of your marriage? Here you are at 3 years. Can you draw on this to make your personal situation stronger? Or do you have any idea yet?
Oh, well, you know, I've heard the word expectations come up lots of times, and I think it's really important to how people feel in their marriages. And I agree with Janice in her assessment of, you know, whether this knowing about the three-year, so-called three-year itch is is dangerous. I think that it's really helpful to know what typical patterns are out there. And it's helpful to understand your own experiences in the context of, you know, the broader picture. Mm. And so, you know, I agree that, you know, every day of a marriage can't be bliss. And so, you know, to kind of understand what's happening in your own life in the broader context of these national trends, I think can be very helpful.
Mm. So you're fully forewarned, and now you've forewarned us as well. Kelly, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Music, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Southern California. I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may. Paul Amato joins us from University Park, Pennsylvania. He conducted the National Longitudinal Study of Marriage from 1980 to 2000. That's a long time and a lot of data. Professor of Sociology, Demography, and Family Studies at Penn State, author of Alone Together and A Generation at Risk. Paul Amato, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me.
Anything surprising you, oh, 20-year wise one, in these new numbers? Has it always been 3 years where the fizz left the tent a little bit?
Well, actually, I don't think we want to necessarily reify this three-year period as being the critical one. Our research, which has followed people, married couples, for 20 years, actually shows that marital happiness begins to decline after the first year. And in fact, it declines more or less continuously throughout the duration of marriage. So that's not a very happy story. But nevertheless, if you just take an overall average of all married people and you track them year to year, you will find this gradual decline. It's not a huge decline, but it's a very consistent and gradual one. And so it really begins earlier than 3 years, and it persists longer than 7 years.
You know, if it starts, if we're saying the happiness ends before a single year is out, that brings me back again, Professor Amato, to wonder if our measures of happiness aren't kind of goofy or superficial. I mean, can it really be true that right across the board, people are almost instantly headed unhappy in their marriage?
Well, some people are. Again, the trend that I've described to you and also the trend that Kelly described to you are really like group averages. And we have to be aware that underlying those averages, or perhaps masked by those averages, are different subgroups of married couples. We do find some couples, for example, who start off very high, very happy with their marriages, and they remain very, very happy with their marriages for long periods of time. Other couples start off in the very first year hitting rock bottom, and they never really get any better. So there's a lot of variability out there in terms of different subgroups. So this general decline we're talking about, I think, is a real one. I think people are being honest with us. We have a large battery of questions that we ask people to try to tap how happy they are with various aspects of the marriage. And I think we're getting at a real phenomenon.
Are there pre-indicators that might lead you to be able to suspect who's more or less likely then to have that durably happy marriage?
Well, I think that some of the things have been touched on briefly already. I think that these days many couples are entering marriage with unrealistically high expectations. We are going through a period when our culture is becoming increasingly individualistic, and people expect to get a lot out of their marriages. They're expecting to find self-fulfillment in marriage, personal growth in marriage. They expect their spouse to be a soulmate. And those are very high expectations, unrealistic expectations. And when couples are married for a year or two, they begin to start having difficulties. All couples have difficulties. All couples have arguments. All couples have disagreements. All couples go through hard times. And when some of these people with unrealistically high expectations start to run into these problems, then they begin to really doubt whether this was the right marriage. Is this person really my soulmate or not? And they may bail out. The divorce rate really begins to go up about year three. Very few people get divorced in the first year or two, but by year three, you're starting to see people bailing ship. So I think partly it's a matter of having realistic expectations that your spouse doesn't necessarily have to be a soulmate, but they should be your best friend.
Wow. It seems like, to me, it's a kind of defining down. We'll look at expectations. Let me get a quick call first from Joe in Middletown, New Hampshire. Joe, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom.
Hi.
Quick question for your guests. I'm aware that it's unfair to compare the honeymoon phase of a relationship with the duration of relationship or marriage.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I don't hear included in any of these conversations is the differences in desire for sex between men and women, particularly men and women in their 40s and 50s. Oh, well, you know, the man wants sex and she doesn't, so he needs to get over it. And there's a lot of pain out there.
So if you end up with a mismatch.
Yeah, biologically, and I'm wondering where that plays a part or not.
Let us look at it, Joe. Janice, how about it? Sexual desire and a mismatch, is that a frequent part of the problem here or not?
That often becomes a frequent part of the problem. Thank you for asking that question. It's actually not more prominent in men. I mean, men having a higher desire than women, it turns out. But when there is a mismatch, that's when the problem comes up. And that's when you need to figure out some solutions and compromises and what the two of you are going to do about that as a couple. And many people come up with many creative solutions, which I can describe to you or not.
Oh, I guess you must.
Well, some people decide on having once a week sex no matter what. And by the way, there is something to be said for having sex even if you don't feel like it, because it really is good for bonding chemicals and for relationship and psychology and intimacy. You just have sex at whatever, sometimes people say, well, let's have it after we have a certain date on a Saturday night, or when the kids aren't around, or only when we go out to a hotel because I'm uncomfortable having, et cetera.
But it sounds like a duty.
Well, it's important to schedule in times for friendship. You do need to become best friends, for physical closeness and for entertainment. And unfortunately, it doesn't just fall in our lap.
So schedule it. What else?
Schedule it and do it. What do you mean?
You said that's one option for dealing with the mismatch problem that Joe describes. Are you pointing to other options as well?
Well, then if there is a problem with libido and sexual desire, then both for women and for men, you should get checked out medically, and there are treatments for that as well.
We heard about that on television, I think, like all the time. Paul, what about in your research? Is this a significant source of decline in happiness?
It can be, and I agree completely with what Janice said, that it's really a case of not how much sex couples are having, but if there's a mismatch. Some couples have sex very infrequently, but that's fine with them. They're both comfortable with that. When there's a mismatch and one partner wants it more than the other, yes, it can be a problem, because the happiness of the marriage is bound up with the happiness of the sex life. But I agree completely with Janice's suggestions. I think they make a great deal of sense.
I'm joined by Paul Amato at Penn State and Janice Levine. She's a marriage therapist. Here's a little clip from the recent film, The Breakup, the leading couple played by Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston fighting over washing the dishes. They're living together, but not even married yet.
You just said that you want me to help you do the dishes.
I want you to want to do the dishes.
Why would I want to do dishes? Why?
See, that's my whole point.
Let me see if I'm following this, okay? Are you telling me that you're upset because I don't have a strong desire to clean dishes?
No, I'm upset because you don't have a strong desire to offer to do the dishes.
I just did.
After I asked you.
I want you to want to do the dishes. And they haven't even begun. In that case, I guess they never do. Let's go to Meg in Middletown, Rhode Island. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just a quick question for your guests about whether they were able to qualify their individuals as to how accountable they felt for their own personal happiness rather than putting it on or projecting it onto their partner.
Ah, that is interesting. Paul Amato, I don't know if that shows up in your 20 years of research, but who's taking responsible, whether people expect their partner to make them happy?
Well, I must admit we did not measure that directly, although I think it's an excellent idea, and I think that the caller is really on to something. I think we do expect an awful lot from our spouses, and again, I think this relates to this increasingly individualistic culture where we go into marriage thinking that a good marriage is one that's going to make me happy, that's going to meet my needs, my spouse is going to meet all my needs for fulfillment and so on, and sometimes people don't think enough about the other side, you know, what they can do for their spouse. In fact, what we have found, and some other people have found, is that when couples willingly make sacrifices for their spouses in the marriage, even small things like you want to go see movie A, your spouse wants to go see movie B, and you decide to go see movie B because you know it would make your spouse happy.
Mm.
Or you want to spend your Christmas with your family, but she wants to spend Christmas with her family, so you decide, okay, we'll go with the in-laws.
And does that end up making people happier, making that sacrifice?
It does in the long run, because what it does is these sacrifices represent a short-term cost for the person who's made the sacrifice, but a long-term benefit because it strengthens the relationship, it strengthens the cohesiveness of the marriage, and the other spouse appreciates it and often will reciprocate and give things back to you. And so a lot of couples these days are focused not enough on sacrifice, but more on, you know, what I can get out of this marriage, but personal fulfillment.
But turn it around the other way, and you may get a kind of virtuous cycle going.
Yes, exactly.
Janice, I'm curious about this expectations business. I work with a lot of young people, 20-somethings, terrific, and I happen to be in the middle of a marriage boom on my staff right now. All kinds of newlyweds around here. I can see people are, you know, really tuned into this. They've seen a lot of divorce in parents' generation. They want to get it right. But what do you see in the expectations that a new generation are bringing into marriage? Are they very different?
Well, I think the expectations are a little bit different, but we are still very much influenced by our past. So we have this sort of conflict between our parents, seeing our parents be married or our parents being divorced, and what the role models are with which we grew up and the ones that we now currently are living in. And that causes conflict for people, and they don't really know what to do with it. They're living in sort of two realities.
What's the difference between the realities? Are the challenges their parents faced are not like their own? Can they not look to them as models? Or?
They are not like their own, actually. It's a very different world that they live in. For example, I find that women still feel like they need to be the primary nurturers. They need to cook, they need to shop, they need to clean, they want to keep a good house.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a lot of social support for that. Well, that's an old, outdated concept, and they feel badly about themselves if they don't do that. And the husbands kind of grew up with that model as well. And even though they're evolved and egalitarian and want to, quote, pitch in, there still is that sort of disparity in expectations.
Does that leave a kind of vacuum of nurture? If the woman doesn't need to do it or can't because she's working and the husband doesn't expect to, does nobody do it? Does that leave a kind of
No, it's exactly what Paul says. It's both. In fact, you can never give too much. You can never love too much. It's not 50-50. You always have to go the distance. And I find in my clinical practice that people who know how to love and be loving individuals are far happier than those who expect to be loved and to have somebody else make them happy.
Mm.
And my favorite quote from Frank Pittman is, marriage doesn't make you happy. Marriage makes you married.
Right. So be married and pour yourself straight into it. Let's go to Lansing, Michigan, and Cynthia. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Well, good day.
Hi.
A wonderful show as always. I so enjoy the program.
Well, thank you.
But I'm calling today because it kind of hit a note with us. My husband and I just celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary on 4th of July.
Congratulations.
Thank
red,
you.
White, and blue.
It was wonderful. He took me on a surprise trip for the first time ever. We went to Philadelphia and then to New York and
just
had a wonderful, wonderful time. But I think that one of the things that happens with the younger generation is they don't really commit to marriage like we did in the past. And sometimes, you know, everything isn't perfect always, but my husband and I have had a very blessed relationship. We met freshman week on campus at the University of Wisconsin and got married between our junior and senior year. And we've had just a blessed marriage, but I think that the younger generation today give up too easy. And if they just hang in there, they could have a beautiful relationship.
So your advice is, even when it's rough, hang in.
Well, I think every situation is completely different, but sometimes I think young people throw in the towel, and then they end up having 2 and 3 marriages and wish they had stuck with the first one.
Cynthia, at 45 years, and congratulations on that, but you've been around long enough to maybe have perspective, be able to look at this straight in the face. Did you ever have an itch? Did he? Do you know?
No, we've just been very happy. I think that one of the things that when I was pregnant, we have 2 sons with our second son. You get a little, when your husband's working very hard, you just really want more time and attention in that respect, but I've always had a very loving husband and a good father to my children, and I just feel like I'm one of the fortunate ones. I have 3 sisters, 2 of us are happily married, 2 are divorced, and I always thought nobody gets married to fail. When you get married, it's the happiest day of your life, and nobody gets married to fail, and things happen in marriage. And I think the 2 of us that kept our marriages, we've been very, very fortunate. And I see how difficult it is when you go through divorce.
Cynthia, we're very glad for that report, and congratulations to you. Thanks for sharing that. Paul, what do you see in very long-term marriages that succeed in that? You've already said part of it is about giving without the expectation of receiving, or certainly without putting yourself first. Are there other common factors to long-lived marriages?
Well, I think that the caller was exactly right when she talked about commitment. Commitment is incredibly important. In fact, we find that the extent to which people are committed to their marriages is a better predictor of who stays together and who gets divorced than marital happiness is. When people are committed to their relationship, they may go through some difficult times. Most couples do go through some hard times, some harder than others. Mm-hmm. But, you know, stuff comes up. Money problems come up. There's children. That adds extra stress onto a marriage. There may be the deaths of one's parents and unemployment. I mean, stuff comes up. Couples who are committed to their marriage, when the marriage starts becoming unhappy and unsatisfying, will say, we're going to stick this out. We're going to ride this out. Because we love each other, because we made a vow to stay together, and we're going to wait and with trust and believe that things will get better over time.
Is it very conscious, Paul? Do couples know whether or not they're deeply committed to one another? I mean, do they?
I think they do. I think when we ask people about it, some people will talk about commitment in very strong terms. They'll say, I am committed to this relationship. I am not going to leave it. I'm here through, for better or for worse. And other couples don't talk in those terms. Other couples with a weak commitment will pack it in, will get a divorce when the going gets rough. And it's that ability to stick with it that really is very common among couples who have long-term happy marriages. Now, I should just qualify that by saying, of course, if there's a marriage where one spouse is abusive or violent, then that's different. There are some marriages that really should end
in that are destructive in that way.
Yes, but so setting aside those really extremely dysfunctional relationships that could be even dangerous, for most marriages, the commitment is a very important feature.
Janice, what do you see in these long-lived marriages, common factors, and this issue of commitment? Do you see people consciously carrying that? Or on the other hand, do weak marriages just not have an awareness of the importance of commitment?
Right. I think you find that the people who dispose of their marriage think it's easy come, easy go, instant gratification, and if it feels good, do it, that kind of, and they're sort of doomed from the beginning if they're looking for it in that way. And clinically and anecdotally, I also believe and underscore the importance of commitment in a marriage. And Paul, you might know the reference on this, but there's a wonderful study. It's a marital therapy study that shows, looks at the intervention of getting therapy when couples are in trouble. And interestingly, and I'm talking against my own field, but there was no difference between those who got therapy and those who didn't at point A and point B. In other words, there was the passage of time alone, being committed, knowing that you'll get to the other side, was sufficient to get people to the other side and be happier.
And you're
even
a therapist
without therapy.
Saying that.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, so, I've seen that. I think Bill Doherty's work and
Bill's,
people, have published it along those lines. It's interesting. But it's really, the key is with the couple themselves, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I think therapists and counselors can be very helpful, but if the couple is not really committed to making it work, they
won't. The couple's not committed, if they don't come to me saying, we want to make this marriage work, then I don't have the tools to make them want to make it work.
What establishes that commitment? Is it the own family history that they came out of? Is it the sort of philosophy in life? I mean, you're talking about something different from
variable.
Love, different from romance.
Right.
It's some, I'm locking in here, and unless it looks like it's going to kill me, I'm sticking with this.
Well, let me say something. It's a grandmother's tale, but I also believe that if you don't have the love and even an ember left, I can't fan it back to life. So you have to have the love. It's an individual variable about whether you feel committed, but it often is very dependent on the models that you grew up with. And if you had a lot of divorce and remarriage, then that seems to be more of an option for you.
Paul, do you have to have seen it to know it? What about people who don't come from families where their parents were married forever?
Well, this is a really important issue because one half of all young adults who are getting married today grew up or spent at least part of their childhood in a single-parent family, right? 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that these 50% of young adults who are getting married now didn't grow up in homes where they had good role models of how to have a happy marriage. They didn't have a chance to see their mothers and fathers negotiate, compromise, express love and affection for one another. Instead, they saw just the opposite. They saw their parents' marriage end in divorce.
But those people are not going to want to hear that they're doomed here. I hope you're not saying that.
No, I'm not saying that. But I do think these young people have some extra challenges. We do know that they tend to, when they marry, they do tend to have lower levels of commitment. And I think it's because they don't trust marriage. Because of what they've seen in their own background.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a lot of these young people, even though they might be very optimistic about their marriages, may lack those interpersonal skills, the ability to negotiate, to compromise, to communicate clearly, and so on, that help marriage to be successful. So I really think that those young adults, in fact, I think anyone who's getting married, really should go through some kind of marriage education program. They're becoming very common these days. They're increasingly accessible, and these are short weekend programs that teach couples basic communication skills, basic interaction skills. The film clip that we heard earlier was very interesting.
Over the Dishes, you mean?
The Dishes. Mm-hmm.
Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a good example of what happens in a lot of unhappy marriages, where a small issue, a small disagreement, escalates out of control. And one of the things that couples can learn is how to de-escalate conflict like that,
mm-hmm.
or to stop and do something that stops that negative interaction from spiraling out of control. These are skills, and people can learn these skills to a certain extent. So I really think marriage education is very useful for, you know, any couple getting married these days.
Janice, when you talk to people who haven't been married long, and they, you know, they're looking for happiness, but do they understand the payoffs of a long-term marriage? How do you describe those payoffs? If they're different from the first 3 years and the kind of buzz that goes right. with that, you know, can you paint a picture of other satisfactions that are worth hanging in for the long haul to achieve?
The one nugget that seems to work with people is when they have children. And everybody knows, anybody who comes into my office, and the research is pretty unequivocal, that when you come from a stable household of two parents, that your children are more insulated against almost all of the social and physical ills of society. And so that seems to be a motivation for people to want to go the distance.
But that's just to spare the children, to save the children. What about in their own relationship, the twosome?
The values are different. The twosome does not necessarily feel that having a 50 or 60 year marriage is, if they're not happy in it, is worth sticking it out.
Paul, what do you find, or what do you say to people who ask you on that front? Can you describe some, you know, nirvana they'll reach if they hang into that third and fourth decade?
Well, you can't always promise people a nirvana. And unfortunately, there are some people who are stuck in pretty unhappy marriages for most of their lives. I mean, that's true. But the couples who stick it out, like that one caller who's been married for 45
mm-hmm.
years, when you reach that length of time, a lot of people report just this incredible sense of security. They've shared a life with a partner. They've grown something. They've grown their children into adults. Many of them by this point in their lives will own their own home. And they can look back and say, the two of us together have created a life together. It might not be a perfect life, but it's a good life. And I think there's something very satisfying at the end of one's life when you can look back and say that we work together well as a team. It's a sense of accomplishment, a sense of meaningfulness in life.
Paul,
and I think, yes, go
can
on.
I ask you something? You said, you know, about the marital decline, and that's a pretty pessimistic outlook. And I'm just wondering, and now you're talking about, you know, the quality of love, which I agree with, that is so different in long-term marriages. Is it possible that it's just a return to baseline and not marital bliss that we're finding?
Yes, I think it's a people are never going to be as ecstatically happy as they were in the first year, after the honeymoon, obviously. But they can reach an agreement. They can reach a rapprochement where they agree to disagree on certain things. And they may not be blissfully happy every second, but they are content. You know, and for many people, that's as good as it's going to get. And actually, that's not so bad.
Right.
Contentment as a way past the itch. I'm grateful to both of you for being here. Paul Amato at Penn State. Paul, thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
And Janice Levine, author of Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Janice, great to have you here.
Thanks.
Good luck, everybody, on those marriages. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
My time is up.